Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
E.T., phone home. It's Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Albums from 1982. Are you ready?
Gag me with a spoon.
Yes. You know, that's quite a violent image, really.
Yes, I know.
I mean, that's no 6'7", but, you know, what are you going to do? All right, so we are the Album Nerds, and this is our podcast. We love albums, the album format, talking about them, dissecting them, and just generally loving on them. We've got a great show for you today. We'll continue our journey loving the 80s, 1982 style. So Don and I will each be presenting an album from 1982. However, our hands were tied and we had to choose from specific genres. And this time it was rock and the rest. The rest being anything that wasn't one of the main genres at the time. Mm-hmm. So we'll get into that. Don's going to ask us a deep question. We'll also have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging. And then, of course, we'll spin the wheel of musical discovery to learn what types of albums we'll be talking about from 1983 next time. But this week, it's all about
1982. That's what I'm talking about.
The I Love the 80s tour hits 1982. Economic worries and Cold War tensions simmer while malls, multiplexes, and MTV pump out bigger, brighter distractions. Rock stars lean into louder guitars and sharper images, while stranger, less commercial sounds bubble along the margins. Today, one of us will dig into a rock album from 1982, and the other brings something from the rest outside typical popular music. So fluff up your feathered hair, straighten that skinny tie, and meet us by the food court pretzel stand. This is 1982.
Okay, so 1982 was really chock full of stuff, and I felt a little hogtied. I would have loved to have talked about Iron Maiden's A Number of the Beast, but we talked about Iron Maiden's first album in 1980, and I believe we've talked about that on the show before, but so I have the rock side this week, so that's what I was digging into. Don, what stuff are you considering?
Well, one I would have done, had we not done it before, was from Philip Glass. You remember that one, Glassworks?
Yeah, that was weird, but cool.
Yeah, yeah. And that was one where, you know, it was supposed to be designed to be listened to on cassette, you know, which was becoming the dominant format at the time.
Yes.
I found something called Bent Burger and Bitter Funeral Beer Band. It's this Swedish drummer. It's like B-E-N-G-T. I don't know how you pronounce that in Swedish. And it's kind of a blend of Indian music and African music and some jazz. Yeah, it wasn't bad. Another one, King Sunny Ade and his African beats. I guess they call it juju music from Nigeria. But those didn't quite make the cut.
Yeah, I mean, I also considered Judas Priest Screaming for Vengeance, but we've talked about that before on the show. Mm-hmm. I know you probably would have loved to have talked about The Cure Pornography, which I think we've also talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But The Police, Ghost in the Machine, Van Halen, Diver Down, that's not my favorite Van Halen album. So I went a direction a little more in the dark. Yeah. We'll get into that shortly.
Some attitude.
Yes. What was that?
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, okay. God. Yes,
I remember. Attitude. It's not a good impression.
No, but it's a good reference. All right. So the picks are in. It's time to phone home to 1982. Let's get to our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
So my pick was from The Rest, and it comes from Brian Eno. He's an English musician and producer born in Suffolk, England in 1948, known initially as guitarist and synth player for the experimental rock band Roxy Music. You know, his early solo work was in glam rock and art rock, but he pivoted towards this ambient generative music in the late 1970s. This is actually his fourth in a series of ambient albums called Ambient 4 On Land. So he basically, you know, works alone with synthesizers and acoustic instruments and environmental recordings.
and deep psychological problems, most likely.
Yeah, I guess this was a sort of a reaction against other ambient music, which he saw as kind of wallpaper or background listening, and he wanted to create an immersive psychological landscape tied to memory and place.
Yes. I mean, there really was a call in 1982. People were like, we need an ambient revolution.
Yes. So it was actually, part of it was influenced by the Fellini film Armor Cord, which was sort of...
You're doing this artistic stuff. Like, we're, all of us that are listening to you right now are like, yeah, of course, the Fellini Cord or whatever.
So this film from 1973 sort of depicted like the unfaithful reconstruction of childhood moments, right? So the idea is our memories are not exact, right? They're flooded with emotion and stuff. And
that's
so
true.
And so when he's capturing these landscapes from his childhood, they're not... you know, true representations. They've been filtered through his lens or whatever. I'll shut up.
This is like NPR right now.
Let's start with the opening cut, Lizard Point.
Wow. This is a tough third album discussion.
Yes.
But I mean, I've been to Lizard Point, and this ain't no Lizard Point. I'll tell you that right now.
Have you really been to Lizard Point?
Of course not. It's probably in England or something.
Yes, it is. So Lizard Point was written and composed by Eno and Michael Beinhorn, Alex Gross, and Bill Laswell. That's the only track that credits some other people. Hmm. Lizard Point is a real location in the southernmost point of mainland Britain on the Cornish coast. You know, it attempts to capture the feeling of standing at a coastal edge, surrounded by wind, sea noise, and a sense of vastness.
Yeah. It feels like, you know... an ominous day, you're looking out at the water and a storm's coming or something. I didn't know they even had lizards in Britain, so yeah. I learned something.
They must be hardy.
Yes. They're wearing London fog raincoats.
It's interesting, you know, because if you think of somebody trying to, you know, capture childhood memories, you know, at the beach or in nature, you would imagine a more positive sound, but there's just lots of droning, dark sounding notes. It sounds very ominous.
I mean, it establishes like unease rather than calm.
Yes, absolutely.
So did he hate his childhood vacations or...
I don't know.
But like there's distant wind, maybe a lot of low frequency hums but organic decay is kind of like this is a polluted beach, you know.
Yes.
So the nuclear fallout is washed up or something, you know.
I get that vibe too. Definitely like a post-apocalyptic thing. Yeah.
And this is just a guy that's, you know, a musical and production genius in many ways to open up his brain and see what the hell happens.
Yeah.
That's cool for that reason.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's hear the second cut on the album. This is one of the longer ones, The Lost Day.
Is that like the clock ticking or something?
Sounds kind of like it.
Sounds like, you know, time passing.
Yeah, so this one is supposedly supposed to evoke like a nautical or harbor atmosphere, sounds that suggest water, rigging, and distant ship horns, and the acoustic environment of a misty port.
I got to give it to you, man. You dug in deep on this, The Rest.
You know, I've always been kind of curious about this. So the first ambient album he did was created to be music for the new Cologne airport at the time, which I thought was fascinating. The idea of like coming up with sounds that would be appropriate for, you know, people traveling, but very different. Actually, I did kind of check out, you know, the other three ambient ones, and this one is the least musical of those, right? Those all have a lot more like piano or synthesizer.
So it was the unluck of 1982 being the one.
Yes. Although many see this one as his most influential or groundbreaking, I guess.
Okay.
One phrase I learned was tape composting. I don't know if you've ever heard this before. I mean, basically, you're feeding older, unused recordings into the mix, and you just keep layering them and layering them until like the original sources become unidentifiable. So that's a technique he used throughout the record. All right. Well, I can tell you, you know, love this album. What's a track you'd like to highlight?
It's not that I don't like it. It's hard to have an opinion on it. It just is what it is. It's background noise that kind of sets a mood. And I found it creepy, and especially this one, this particular song, Lantern Marsh. Sounds like whale sounds or something.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's probably strings or synth strings or something, but it evokes this marsh in East Anglia, you know, knew primarily from a map, but he says that he thought he had visited it at some point. But again, it's more that emotional resonance and memory stuff. It's just figurative. It's like a painting. You're stepping into a painting. You know, these are audio paintings in a way. It, again, layered, slowly evolving pads and tones, environmental sounds, no beat. Not much. What's representing organic places is not very organic sounding.
No.
But it's more that sense of place, imagination, passive presence. So listening to this, even while working, it's so subtle that sometimes you don't even hear it, but it still kind of fills the room with sound.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
I did have it on a lot when I was working, and I do wonder if it maybe triggered a different part of my brain or something. I feel like I may have worked a little differently, you know, while I was listening to it. I'm not, you know, because it's different from listening to nature sounds or whatever that are just, you know, just sort of background. This one was like, I mean, I was feeling it as I was hearing it.
Yeah, I had it in the room on four speakers, but then I did try it with headphones, and that's when it was a little different, where it was more of just like this, you know. If you wanted to fall asleep and have uneasy, nightmarish dreams, this would be perfect. But it is foggy and spooky, and maybe these childhood memories are not, these places were not bright places for Eno.
Yes. All right. Well, we get to the end of the album with a song called Dunwich Beach, Autumn 1960.
Yeah, I'm sure that the Dunwich Beach people were clamoring to use this for their commercials to come to Dunwich Beach for your vacation now. Look at the dead seals on the beach.
I would say this is probably the most musical of the songs on the album. And there is actually, there's some guitar in there. I'm not sure if those sustained notes there were the guitar, played by a Michael Brook, called it an infinite guitar technique. So just these sustained hovering tones. You're probably familiar with Daniel Lanois, who worked with U2 famously and other artists. So he's actually on this album as well. Lanois, I guess, was working on live equalization. So I just picture him kind of riding the faders or whatever. Yeah, you know, it's quite an album. It's like you said, it's sort of hard to talk about or, you know, say whether you love it or hate it. You know, it's like looking at an abstract painting, maybe, or
it's like, you know, which you can see different every time you look at it if you're at a museum. I think the important part about this album is really just its existence in 1982, not something one thinks about the 80s and nostalgia and all that. This is not something I think would normally come to mind, and that's why we made it hard on ourselves and put this the rest category in the mix for the wheel to unleash upon us.
Yeah, it's good to be challenged. All right, time to rewind and reflect on Brian Eno's Abstract 4 on Land. I'll begin with my clickbait headline. Foggy moods and squishy shoes, a walk through Eno's weird, wet sound world.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, so just slow-moving, beatless soundscapes, low drones, instruments that are unrecognizable, and then just environmental noises. And there are noises in there that triggered my dog a couple of times.
You know? Well, maybe that's what it should have been called, Ambient 4, Music for Dogs.
Yeah. I do think there probably is a connection to You know, the work that Eno is maybe more famous for as a rock producer who's worked with, you know, the Talking Heads and David Bowie and U2. You know,
it would probably just unlock some weird thinking, some ways of approaching the you know, pop and rock songs that maybe he wouldn't have if he hadn't played around with the stuff. I don't know. I have no evidence, but it feels like for a creative like Eno, what would be the point of doing that stuff if it didn't inform you moving forward?
Yeah, there's this idea, I think, that it's not about recording or capturing songs. It's about capturing a sound space, and you've just got musicians adding to that space.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
So I think that is his approach to production on things like The Unforgettable Fire and
And
The Talking Heads Remain in Light.
Okay, so now I'll, you know, to sum things up of my overall vibe for Ambient 4 on Land. That's my clickbait headline. I call it Eno Grigio.
That's good.
Or I could say Ambient 4 on Land. Side effects may include drowsiness, stillness, and nervously staring at the wall. Because of Ambien. Mm-hmm.
I guess Pinot Grigio could do that too.
Yeah. Eno Grigio.
Yes, that's right.
It's intentionally unsettling. And I think, unlike Music for Airports, which was supposed to be calming, I think he was playing with the other side of that. And, you know, it is what it is. It's cool. And it's a guy who contributed a ton to music, wonderful albums that I love. So I can't hate on it because it's a building block in his process.
Yeah, I don't know if we really need to do killer to filler on this one. Because, I mean, what is there? Oh, this one just awful. I don't know what he was thinking. You know, is that a rhinoceros in there?
It's a piece. It's a painting. It's a soundscape. And if you listen to it, it's just going to do what it do.
Mm-hmm. So the production, I mean, this whole thing is in, you know, in exercise and like art production. You know, I do think it's probably, you know, groundbreaking, you know, in terms of, you know, that tape composting method I talked about. And, the difference between like background and foreground, I guess he deliberately tried not to highlight one particular sound in the way that you would make sure that the vocals are always, you know, in the front of the mix for people to hear. He wanted to just make it more natural. If you're walking around in nature, you know, you can't dictate what's in your foreground.
Yeah. For the production, for me, was the restraint. Like, this is a other albums I've listened to that Eno's involved with, including like his stuff with Roxy Music. It's not restraint, and there's a lot of holding back sounds, not letting them go full force. And I really feel like it anticipates the film scoring.
Oh yeah,
that happens. Also, environmental audio, post rock atmospherics, and it's still. I mean, it could be made today and no one would question it. I think it just goes to show that ambient sounds have become a part of music now.
Yeah. You mentioned restraint. I wonder if he had to fight the urge to throw in some melody.
Yeah. Could be. That could use a little guitar. No. No. Brian?
Replay value? I liked that it made my mind wander. So it made me think a little bit differently.
We don't do a lot of that these days. No. Let our minds wander. As soon as something isn't happening, we're looking at our phones.
So. Yes, that's true. So I don't know. I wonder if, you know, maybe if I have writer's block or something, you know, for work, or, you know, maybe, you know, pop this on and just experience it differently.
For replay, I'd say it doesn't demand replay.
No.
It invites it. You know,
there you go.
Like, if you want to come on in. And I think we kind of hinted at the legacy stuff of how it kind of quietly reshapes ambient music, proves that ambient can be dark, doesn't have to be on the light side of things, you know, what it might have done for Eno as an artist.
Yeah. You know, again, it's so much darker than other things in the ambient world.
Perhaps. I mean, I'm sure that it's gotten much darker since from, you know, other performers making albums, but.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't something you would play in a spa.
Well, and it's just so interesting because of 1982, where people were still thinking in album, you know, so this is still an album of songs that were collected specifically to work together. I think if you keep that in mind while listening, it can help open up the experience a little bit.
Well, Ambient 4 on land turns vague memories and half-imagined places into sound. If those kinds of landscapes interest you, spend some time there and tell us what you find.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. All right, so like we did for 1980 and 1981, what are some significant music-related moments or developments in 1982?
I'm going with one of the more obvious ones on the album front, Michael Jackson's Thriller, which we've mentioned numerous times already in this I Love the 80s experience, released November 30th, 1982. It was more than an album. It was an impact item that redefined the industry, really, and how record labels could make money. It set new standards for production quality. Quincy Jones's obsessive perfectionism and studio polish kind of was the new norm after that. Music videos becoming high budget narrative cultural events, pushing MTV, which was just growing, kind of feeding off of each other. It was a long term event. This album was like on the charts forever. They just kept releasing singles and kept it going, and that was one of the first times that an album like was squeezed of everything it had for 3 years or something.
Yeah, I don't think I bought the album until like early 1984,
and it was still top of the charts.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's like 9 singles off of it or something. So released amid MTV's rise, new technology, globalization, Thriller was the essential bridge like between radio and television and fashion and film and spectacle and culture. And I was a little kid, but it was pretty magical and really my first time of having my own music that wasn't, you know, my parents liked it, but it was mine. I scraped together enough money from doing a once a week little paper out in the neighborhood bought the record. So
nice. Yeah. I wonder if it maybe changed the focus of albums for a while into just being like cram as many hits onto it as you can. And maybe thinking about it less as a, you know, what one piece of art,
kind of more back to the early 60s, you know, a series of singles collected as an album rather than, you know, a narrative or like, although that stuff was always still going, but sure. Like the high selling things. All right. What about you, Don? What caught your attention in 82?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a specific moment, but I guess more a phenomenon. Some people have pointed to 1982 as being, you know, the last year that was truly dominated by rock on the pop charts. So rock acts held the number one spot in the top 40 for 44 out of the 52 weeks. So you had songs like I Love Rock and Roll, Centerfold, Eye of the Tiger, Jack and Diane. But then you move on to 1983 and you've only got 21 weeks. And those rock artists are like The Police and Men at Work and Toto and Dexy's Midnight Runners. So, you know, maybe that, you know, it is sort of a turning point in popular music at the time.
Absolutely.
What are some other significant musical moments or developments of 1982? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook, at Album Nerds.
So this is rock, but it's missing some of the elements you'd expect. It's got a man and his guitar for the most part. It's Bruce Springsteen with Nebraska from September of 1982, produced, kind of, engineer Mike Batlin. Sixth studio album by the singer-songwriter, born Bruce Friedrich Joseph Springsteen in 1949. Friedrich Frankenstein in Long Branch, New Jersey, frontman of the E Street Band, of course. By the early 80s, was already established as a major live performer, big concert, reputation for emotionally intense and narratively rich albums, but Nebraska was recorded largely as a solo home demo series on a simple four-track cassette. They were supposed to be demos for the next record for him and the band to do. They ended up deciding this was the most powerful presentation of the songs. intimate character-driven song cycle focused on drifters, small-town criminals, and people crushed by economic and moral breakdown in Reagan-era America, what you were kind of talking about for 1982. Why don't we just kind of jump into the thing? We know who Bruce Springsteen is.
He wasn't the boss yet, I don't think, was he?
No, he wasn't quite the boss. I think this gave him the confidence and the tools necessary to take that on and on the next record, Born in the USA in 1984. But why don't we jump into Nebraska with the opening and title track, Nebraska.
From a town of Lincoln, Nebraska, with a sawed-off 410 on my leg.
So this song is a first-person narrative based on the real-life 1957 to 58 killing spree of Charles Starkweather, a 19-year-old from Lincoln, Nebraska, and his 14-year-old girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate. They murdered 10 people over an 8-day period across Nebraska and parts of Wyoming before being captured. Starkweather was executed in Nebraska in 1959. Fugate served many years in prison before being released, but Springsteen sings as if he's the killer. And there's a movie called Badlands, which I watched with Martin Sheen, loosely based on this story. It's not, the characters aren't the Starkweather and Fugate, but it's their story told through, you know, different locations and stuff, but the same thing. It's about darkness in America and in life. And even in the bright and beautiful 50s, I think, you know, people are always like, it was better back then, all that kind of stuff. The emotional and moral center of the song is like in some of the final lines when Charlie is talking to the police. And I love how he's always calling them sir and stuff.
Yeah.
But they wanted to know why I did what I did. Well, sir, I guess there's just a meanness in this world. Just that evil exists and I'm a tool for evil, you know, kind of a thing. But it is a fascinating case in terms of, like, I'm originally from Nebraska, so my mom was probably a little kid when this was happening. And she lived in a town about 40 minutes from Lincoln, a little farm town, and they were scared. People were just scared.
Mm-hmm.
Little, you know, town of 300 people, they're locking their doors for the first time ever. And she told me this story when I was a little kid. So I always had Charlie Starkweather as a, you know, boogeyman kind of character in my life. So this really hit hard for me, this song.
Yeah, it's so chilling. You know, and I mean, the coldness with which he's, you know, speaking, I guess, you know, he's speaking from Starkweather's, or he's singing from Starkweather's perspective. And, you know, he's not really, he can't say he's sorry.
Right.
And but he's just singing so matter of factly, you know, that it's just really like, I don't know.
It's chilling.
Yeah. It's quite a moving song. And
yeah,
I guess that's the magic of this album, because it's just mm-hmm. Springsteen and a guitar, but I'm so moved by it. It's really, I mean, it's sad and depressing. I mean, I could see a metal band, you know, trying to tackle this subject, you know, like a Rob Zombie or a...
Yeah, but it wouldn't be...
It wouldn't be as good.
Emotional, you know? No.
Yeah.
It would just be violent.
Yes.
All right, why don't we move past that to a song about the depressing parts of being human. This one's called Atlantic City.
Trust and I bought us two tickets on that Rose City bus. Everything dies.
So this brings us back to New Jersey. This is the second track on the album. So it is, you know, it's a sad tale, but it's more of just a story about, you know, being down on your luck and all of that stuff. And it seems like a real upswing from Nebraska, but it tells the story of a working man pushed toward desperation by economic hardship. It starts off with they blew up the chicken man in Philly last night. Now they blew up his house too. And the chicken man refers to a Philadelphia mafia boss, Philip Chicken Man Testa, and grounds the song in real criminal history of the region, right? And this guy is in, you know, up to his ears in debt to the mob, and is trying to let's take what we have and go to Atlantic City, which I guess was not the bright place it is now. It was a depressing, mob infested town, and he was, you know, maybe having to do stuff for the mob he didn't want to do, but just trying to survive.
It's a great hook. Everything that dies someday can, you know, it's something I could sing along with, or, you know.
Oh, yeah. You know. Absolutely. Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. Yeah, it's hard. And that's with the E Street Band behind it, it's a little bit different vibe of the song, but it can be a big banger as well.
Sure. Yeah, I guess this was, so it was somewhat inspired by, I guess it's a Louis Malle film. I don't know how you pronounce the person's name. So I'm just amazed, you know, because, you know, Bruce Springsteen plays this kind of like blue collar, ordinary guy character. But I mean, he's so well read and intellectual, obviously.
Yeah. You know? I saw a little documentary thing about how he read, but really he took in tons of movies. Mm. Him and the E Street Band, they all did. And they, like, he loved watching movies about real stuff. And I think those movies painted a lot, helped him paint. It was, you know, a piece of the puzzle of putting this album together. Mm. But yeah, I love that it simultaneously faithfully reflects a historical setting and real stuff, and speaks of the universal struggles of love and debt and risk and hope and all of that. All right, Don, did you have a song you wanted to focus on here that maybe will bring up the lights a little bit in the room?
Yeah, well, so apparently a lot of the songs that ended up on Born in the USA also came out of, you know, these songwriting sessions. And I was trying to think, you know, is there a song on here that maybe would have fit on Born in the USA? So I think maybe one of those is Open All Night.
Definitely. Also on those demos and stuff, you can hear what Born in the USA sounded like at first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really
the real one's better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I believe this is the only track on the album that features an actual electric guitar. And this song actually goes back quite a few years for Springsteen. I guess it was originally called Wanda. That was the working title back in 1979 when he was working on sessions for The River. You know, I guess a Chuck Berry-inspired guitar riff.
Yeah, I would say so.
And it's another one where he's on the road, you know, I think, you know, driving to get to his baby. The song actually right before this is called State Trooper. And that's another one where when he's on the road, but I think he's on the run because he just committed some crimes and he doesn't want to get pulled over by the state police.
Yeah, please don't pull me over, Mr. State Trooper. Yeah, it's.
I heard somebody write about it. You know, they said it's almost like two passing cars on the same highway.
Yeah.
You know, which is interesting. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this one definitely could have gotten the full band treatment if you wanted.
Yeah, but, you know, we got a working class man on the night shift racing through North Jersey to reach his lover, Wanda, for a late night dinner, in quotes. But yeah, it emphasizes human desire for connection, and that persists even amidst struggle, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's another cool one. Like, because of the pace, it feels like driving, you know, speeding through the, you know, trying to get to your destination and looking forward to something.
Right. Yeah, and it's kind of a nice break in the album. I think we got two more tracks after this that are, you know, going to be back to the darkness. Yep. And so this is like a little intermission, I think.
All right, speaking of darkness, we close it out. Although there's light at the end of the tunnel here. This is the final track. It's called Reason to Believe. Some kind of fun is hurting me. Still at the end of every hard day, people find some reason to believe. So unlike a lot of the other tracks on Nebraska, with single story narratives, this one has kind of four little vignettes tied together. A man finds a dead dog on the side of the road. A woman is waiting for her lover. There's a birth and death by the river. A groom abandoned at the altar. But all of them have these terrible things happen. But somehow humans get through a hard day and they find some reason to believe that things will be better tomorrow. And that's a unique thing of the human condition. And there's hope. We all have hope, even in our darkest moments, and I like that.
Yeah. Although there are different interpretations of it, and like Springsteen himself, and I never trust songwriters because it's all like what mood they're in when you ask them a question. But he said it was more about the price that blind faith and refusing to give up your illusions extracts from you.
I reject that.
Yeah.
That's my reason to believe that the darkness in this album, like it's that song gives me like, okay, tomorrow can be better.
Yeah. And I think if you asked Springsteen on a different day, he might have said that.
Sure.
But yeah, it's a catchy song. It's another one that could have had a full band arrangement too, I think.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think it's a good final track. That dark journey could you know, either be a descent into nihilism or it could be a study of human resilience.
Yeah.
And that's the way I see it, at least today.
Yeah, it could almost be a gospel tune.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know we've said a lot about just four songs. So why don't we try and sum some things up as we rewind and reflect on Nebraska. All right. To try to gather my thoughts, my overall vibe, I'll go with the clickbait headline. To describe the album, no band, no glory, a four-track, some stories, and his demons. Mm-hmm. Nebraska is where the boss earned the title. Stark, intimate, emotionally uncompromising. It's like overhearing confessions, deeply personal, often uncomfortable, and 100% human. And I think the treatment, the simple treatment, not making it a big band album was brilliant. Probably didn't sell as many copies because of that. I believe Springsteen was having his first bout of serious depression, which his father had as well. And him and his dad had relationship issues. And I think a lot of that was coming out. I think this was Bruce giving himself therapy. I don't think he knew he was doing it, but I think that's what was happening on these, and as he made these songs, you know, in that room, that bedroom in his house or whatever. And then, you know, there are recordings of the band trying to do this stuff.
Yeah, I did start to listen to some of those.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would recommend listening to the real thing first. Mm-hmm. It's all, you know, because it was recorded on cassette, doesn't really have a good master or anything, and there's echo in it and stuff, which I think are just degradation of the tape. Like, it just sounds so real.
Yeah.
And that's what's cool about it. But the Nebraska treats songs as miniature short stories with characters trapped by circumstance, morality, or geography, and it's good stuff.
Yeah, my clickbait headline is Springsteen temporarily breaks free from the gaudy chains and glockenspiels of the E Street Band. So yeah, you know, same idea. It's this treatment just really demonstrates how great of a songwriter Springsteen is. You don't need all that extra gaudy band stuff. Although over the years, I've grown to appreciate that sound as well. But this might be my favorite version of Springsteen.
I mean, I love what comes next with Born in the USA. And
me too.
I believe that the demons that were exercised during this process are what allowed him to go as bigger than ever before on the next one. Killer to Killer, because there's no filler.
Yeah, I agree.
What other songs do you want to quickly mention?
One of my favorites is Highway Patrolman, where you know the character has a brother that's troubled. You know, I don't know. It's a story. Like I feel like I didn't have a brother, but I feel like I know people who have brothers that were troubled and that you're always trying to take care of, but you know, they're always gonna get into trouble and you never know how to handle it. Johnny 99 is another one that's maybe got a slightly more upbeat treatment, but it's not an upbeat narrative. I think that's one where is it an auto worker who kind of snaps and starts killing people?
Yeah, and then he gets 99 years in prison, but wishes that he had gotten the chair or whatever instead. Mansion on the Hill, where this is more from Springsteen's actual memories, an adult narrator reflecting on his childhood experience of class division, the literal hill that physically divides a small town. He's poor and they're rich, and you know, looking at that and thinking how much better life could be. State Trooper, another. This one mentions Highway Patrolman is kind of like on the Michigan line, so maybe traveling from Ohio to Michigan or something. State Trooper is about a state trooper on New Jersey Turnpike at night, and this is one where it's like please don't, Mr. State Trooper, please don't stop me, you know. So did something bad. Used cars, another one from his childhood, learning a lesson of, you know, they're poor and they can't buy a new car and he'll never buy a used car. You know, the little kid in him being like, I don't want to be like my dad who can't, you know, who can't get what he wants. My father's house, again, second to last song, focusing on his experiences with his dad and their kind of strained relationship. But yeah, great stuff all the way around.
Yeah, I think we mentioned them all.
I think we probably did. There's only 10, so you know, who can blame us? Production-wise, that lo-fi cassette recording with the tape hiss and the room ambience and minimal overdubs and sparse, it just conveys narrative and the realism of it all.
Yeah, I guess a lot of effort went into converting that cassette into a vinyl record.
Yeah, it was not of good quality. Replay value, high.
Oh, yeah.
Each listen reveals deeper character connections and layers and kind of opens up the rest of his catalog. You know, like this is the bones of a Bruce album. And once you see the X-ray, then in the other albums, like I was listening to Tunnel of Love, which I've always thought was meh, I was focusing on the words, not the sounds around it. And this kind of unlocked that for me, this album.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just not, you know, it's probably not for every occasion, you know, when you have a party or something, you know, it's not good. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, this is an all-time great album.
Legacy-wise, it redefined rock album expectations. This is the blueprint for Unplugged, as far as I'm concerned. Sure. That whole movement that came later, I feel like this is the first example of how powerful that can be.
So, you know, the idea of a lo-fi home recording, I think is something that some, you know, more modern artists have embraced. Bon Iver, Iron and Wine, Neutral Milk Hotel, even, you know, some of your early hip hop producers, you know, sort of embraced the idea of just using the 4-track cassette recorder as your studio.
Innovative stuff by being not innovative.
Yep.
So Nebraska closes in darkness, but it's that very darkness that gave rise to the Bruce who just a couple of years later turned struggle into anthems. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
So on your way home from Ridgemont High, did you have a chance to listen to anything else and dig it?
I barely did. I got this in late yesterday afternoon, came out Friday. This one is Alter Bridge, self-titled album, Alter Bridge, an American hard rock quartet, Miles Kennedy, Mark Tremonti, Brian Marshall, and Scott Phillips, known for their blend of alternative metal, post-grunge, melodic riffs, yada, yada, yada. This is their self-titled 8th studio album, and it's them embracing their signature sound with powerful riffing and vocal interplay and all that. Let's listen to a little bit of Silent Divide. So you'll find this one on Napalm Records. It was 12 tracks recorded at the legendary 5150 Studios and produced by Michael Elvis Basket. Confident statement of identity deeper into their career here. So 20 years, they've been doing their thing. But yeah, 5150 and Elvis. Elvis is the producer for Mammoth as well.
Oh.
And Wolfgang Van Halen was the bass player for Tremonti's solo project band for a couple of years. So there's some connections there as well. So, of course, I had to go to the album collection for a 1982 pick. And I've got Toto.
Mm.
Not in Kansas anymore, Toto. Not that Toto. It's the band. American rock band formed by seasoned Los Angeles session musicians. Pop rock, album oriented rock, jazz influenced.
Now they get the yacht rock.
Yes, I guess. Some of the musicians from Toto actually worked on Thriller as well. But this one is Toto 4, and let's listen to a little bit of Rosanna. So, you know, more your kind of soft rock stuff. Africa is on this one too, which Weezer covered a few years ago. Yeah. But yeah, the record reached top 5 on the US Billboard 200. And I grew up with Toto playing on the radio, and it's fun to have on vinyl. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
It was like $5. So it's nice. What you got there, Donnie?
Well, thanks to Pandora, I discovered some artist, kind of a mystery artist, name of Butch Daines, just a lot of singles and a Christmas EP. I was intrigued by the name because I think it's a reference to the Gilmore Girls. I won't get into it.
please don't.
I'm not sure if he's just a producer and songwriter, but kind of a retro, kind of Motown sounding vibe. Here's a track called Amelia. And there's a couple other singles that sound kind of more like in the Phil Spector girl group vibe. Butch Daines operates out of WMPY Studios, whatever that is. he bills it, you know, old-time sounds of the past. So it's a retro aesthetic. And Peter Gabriel is coming back.
What? Right?
Remember his last album was called I.O., which was like Inside Then Outside or something? Well, now the new album's going to be called O.I.,
Hey,
I knew we'd both go there.
Yeah. Who's the boss?
But he's doing the same thing again, where he has like the dark side and the bright side mix, or whatever.
Okay.
I don't know. But so he's releasing, just like he did last time, a different single every month to coincide with, you know, the phases of the moon. But so there's one song out now. It's called Been Undone.
I'll totally listen to it when the album's out. I mean, you can't deny Gabriel at least a shot.
Yeah.
He's an archangel after all.
so, you know, apparently he'll be exploring themes of artificial intelligence, quantum computing, humanity's relationship with nature and technology.
Let me guess, this is going to be on a 4-track recording with just him and maybe that'd be guitar.
That'd be nice.
AI revolution.
Ooh, I like that. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, here we are. It's a time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of singer, songwriter, model, and actress Grace Jones.
I just saw her on the Pee Wee's Playhouse Christmas special.
That's a brilliant performance. She says, there is some 80s music that is just timeless and some that is so dated it's embarrassing. With that in mind, let's bring out the wheel of musical discovery to find out what kind of albums we'll be exploring in 1983.
Oh, how embarrassing.
Next time, we continue our I Love the 80s series with 1983. Big hooks, bold personalities, and chart-dominating vibes take center stage as we dive into R&B and pop, spotlighting two albums that helped define one of the decade's biggest breakthrough years.
R&B and pop. All right, well, that's a little easier to wrestle.
Yes.
R&B and pop.
We can do this. Maybe a little upbeat, hopefully.
Yeah. Let's have some fun. No more lizards and state troopers.
All right. What's your favorite album from 1982 or 1983? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And you can visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 322 episodes. And the best way to support this show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you so much for joining us once again on the Album Nerds podcast. 1983 is a calling. You going to answer?
Yes.
Wow. So deep.
All right. You ready to guess your 1982 television show theme?
Yes, sir.
Here we are, face to face, a couple
spoons.
Of Album Nerds. Okay. Yes, Silver Spoons.
Yeah.
The Ricker.
I love The Ricker. I wanted to be The Ricker, yeah.
But it was a good year for debuts. You had St. Elsewhere, Cheers, Family Ties.
Yeah,
not bad.
Yeah. All right, y'all. See you in 83.